What's up, everyone? If you're just now tuning in to Coaching Mud, then you should definitely check out the earlier episodes before listening to this one. I've had some pretty cool guests. This podcast is a platform for coaches to share their journeys getting through what we like to call the mud. Whether you're a graduate assistant, a coach with 30 plus years of experience, or everything in between, you've had to work to get to where you are. All of our journeys are different. This platform allows coaches to share those journeys while also educating aspiring coaches of what it takes to make it in this profession. PSA, I am still actively figuring this out. Also, if you or someone you know is interested in sharing their coaching journey, please do not hesitate to reach out. I would love to hear from you. Enjoy. On today's episode, I spoke with Coach Kevin White of the University of Wisconsin at Stout. Coach White has 18 years of coaching experience under his belt, and this is his first year as his team's Midwest recruiting coordinator. He began his coaching career at the age of 11. Well, actually, that's when he fell in love with coaching. But since beginning his journey as a coach, he's been at the high school level, junior college level, and Division III. In this episode, he tells us about the transition from coaching at the high school level to college, mistakes made earlier in his career, the evolution of his recruiting, and so much more. Let's roll it back and hear how it went. All right, Coach. So tell me, how did you get into coaching?
It's kind of a funny story. Not really funny, but it's a unique story. My dad passed away when I was 10 years old, and my fifth grade gym teacher was the varsity basketball coach at my high school. And he asked me one day if I wanted to go to a game. And 20 plus years later, I'm still involved with the game of basketball. My high school coach ended up naming my high school coach my godfather. And he kind of got me started in being around the gym and being in the game all the time. And without having a father in my home, he really took me under his wing and kind of started me at a young age. So I knew at 11 or 12 what I wanted to do. So I have never done anything else but this. So thanks to him for stepping up and being a father figure for me and being a role model for me. I saw how he impacted people's lives, and I want to do the same thing.
Wow, that's awesome. That early?
Yeah, that early. 10 or 11 years old, in the gym with the whiteboard. Yep. It's really, 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 really early. It was kind of nice. It was really easy to behave during the winter. My mom was like, if you don't behave, you're not going to be going to any games. So it was really easy to toe the line in my house at a single-parent home. So I didn't want to miss any games or practices, so I needed to be good as a little kid.
Yeah, I bet. Anything that you drew up when you were 11, 12 years old, you still use today?
I used a back screen, flare screen action. I've taken with me everywhere. And I actually wrote on a napkin when I was like 13 or 14. And my high school coach at the time had a 6'9 center. And they used to always want to take the back screen away, but we had a kid who could shoot. And I was just messing around in his office one day, like I was every day. And he said, stop, what are you doing? So I literally just made this up. He was like, no, draw that up again. And he gave me a look like, that's actually not bad. And I was like, what? I did something right? He was like, I'm not going to run that play for you when you get to the varsity, but this will work for this year's team. I was like, okay. So I've kind of always kept that back screen, flare screen. Because if you think about it, it would be really hard to guard two actions at once. So, but that's just from being around the game all the time and messing around. And even now that I'm older, I just have a pen and paper and draw stuff up and mess around with stuff to see what works.
That's great. Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. A back screen into a flare screen into a back screen is extremely hard to guard.
Yes. Yeah. So it makes things kind of fun. Pencil and paper, at a restaurant or out to dinner. My wife sometimes has to put down some ground rules and we used to go out to eat before COVID. Okay. No drawing on the napkin at this meal. So.
Oh my gosh. So you've been doing this pretty much since you were 11, 12 years old. You've known, okay, this is what I want to do. But was there ever a point in this journey where you questioned if it was something that you truly wanted to pursue or maybe were even capable of pursuing?
I think when I was done playing, I only played in junior college for 2 years. And going into my second year, I had to make a choice if I wanted to keep coaching or wanted to go on to a four-year school and just go to school. And I wanted to do both, and I had to find a way to do both. That's how I ended up at Kalamazoo College. But there was a time there for about 3 months when I was like, okay, I'm 5'8". So playing after this? How much more am I going to play after this? And of course, like I mentioned before, my family and my high school coach were like, you know, you can't play forever, but you can coach forever. And that's once they told me that, I was like, okay, I'm good. My mind is made up. I'll eat hot and ready so I can figure out a way to pinch pennies to have a decent living and just coach as long as I can. So there was a short period of time when I thought about it, but I've always had good family support, and I've always had my high school coach in my ear giving me positive feedback. So I kind of never want to give up on my dream.
I love that. I love that you mentioned the time period of having to sacrifice and grind and eat hot and readies, because that's true.
Yeah, hot and readies and getting a loaf of white bread and bologna and trying to stretch that out, or understanding that during the season you're going to get at least two dinners a week for free because you're going to have two away games, you're going to have two road trip bus meals on the way back from a game, or extra pizza after a home game. I mean, you talk about the levels I've been at. I've never been in a big budget school where there's this abundance of money and abundance of travel. So you had to find a way to make ends meet.
Yeah, my go-to was Top Ramen.
There we go. Got to have it. You can get that for $5, $10 at the – and then it also was making connections in the towns I was in. Some of the cities I've been were small. So at one point we were winning. There was a breakfast place I'll never forget. Miss Mary would just a little extra to go in your to-go container. Coach, I got you. She kind of winked and you just leave. So as long as we were winning, she got our front row seat. So I made sure Miss Mary at Glen Oaks, if she ever listened to this, she had a front row seat to every one of my games when I was assisting at Glen Oaks. So she put a little extra eggs in my to-go container.
That's great. Shout out to her.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So before you became a college coach, you were coaching at the high school level. So tell me about that transition from high school to college. What were some of the challenges that you had?
One of the main challenges you have is I was close in age with the players when I was started coaching college. So I was 19, 20 when I started. Well, I was 20, 21 coaching college, high school. And then I went to college and I was a little bit older than the guys that were seniors. So one thing I had to do was make the separation between friend and coach, and then understand that I'm 21 and they're 21 and I can't be in the same establishments they're in. So that was some of the challenges. And then recruiting, sitting in the family's living room and trying to sell them on a dream, or sell them on a institution that, you know, you just graduated from or just finished from. So those were some of the challenges. And then just understanding that in college, the hours that you put in are way longer than high school. And then leaving the office at 5 is no longer an option. And, you know, practicing games and that's it are no longer an option. Or making sure the 12th man on the bench or 13th man on the bench are getting extra reps and extra practice time. And then film study, that's a whole other podcast talking about film study. But I mean, just learning how to do all that was really, really different from making the jump.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I can totally relate to that in all aspects. And it's funny that you mentioned film study, because I don't think I realized, among many other things, the detail and the intricacies of doing a scouting report using Synergy. I mean, it's crazy how much time and effort, especially just like editing the clips, let alone watching the clips and making sure you choose the right ones. But so props to all my coaches that did that, and for me not necessarily appreciating it the way that I should have.
Well, I don't think the players really appreciate it. They just walk in the film room, sit down, and the clips just kind of roll, and the head coach's got the clicker and you're trying to make sure they're in order. You're trying to make sure you can put two in the same slot. But I was started so young that I used to have to go live scout. So some of my scouts starting out as an assistant coach, I'd have to drive 2 hours to the University of Chicago, take as many notes as I can, come back, type them up, and then give the team a paper scout. So I was a little bit ahead of my, you know, I had to start with non-video at first. So learning video was really difficult.
Yeah. So earlier in your career, what are some mistakes that you make and how did you learn from them?
I think one of the biggest mistakes I made was definitely not using building bridges and networking with other coaches in our conference or outside of our conference, and spending time with other coaches trying to learn. I kind of had a small bubble and I stuck to that bubble. And I also didn't recognize the importance of building networks with high school coaches or college coaches. Even my high school coaches that maybe I played against as a player in high school or coached against as a high school coach, I didn't reach back out and try to build those networks and keep those connections, because everybody through two people. I kind of went through a couple of your podcasts. There's about 5 people that you've already interviewed that I know through somebody else. So you realize in the coaching world, it's not that big of a gap. It's not like another line of work. So networking was one of the first mistakes I made. And then sharpening my iron with skill development. I kind of just got to do what my head coach told me as an assistant, never reached out to learn more about skill development. So I've kind of spent this COVID time to help gain more experience doing player development, because you can always get better as a player development. But the players want to learn, but they don't want to do the same drills every day. So you got to make sure you're doing the right kind of stuff in player development.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's funny, you know, you mentioned networking, and I kind of just talked about this on the recruiting aspect of things, is as far as with building bridges, you never know where a coach is going to end up or where a recruit is going to end up. So if you don't have necessarily a strong first impression or whatever with a certain coach, 2 years later, they end up being in your conference, you know, or right. They end up being your boss or something. So it's just so funny. Like, and I mean, even on the flip side of that, I'm like, you know, if I didn't have such a good first impression of a coach, I've had it where I'm like, okay, well now we're in the same conference, so it's go time. Like now you're on my list, you know, like things like that. And I'm sure it's just for everybody across the board that happens.
For sure. And I think coaches now are a little bit different. Like way back in the Dean Smith era, I don't know if, you know, coaches were going out to dinner the night before a game and staying in the same city and spending time. But with social media and that kind of stuff, I mean, when the ball goes up, it's one thing, but we have so many things going on in our world right now. I think coaches have realized you have to have the separation between competition and still being professional and spending time together. My new head coach that I work for, Jim Lake, the only reason why I got this opportunity is because I coached with the same travel team as he did after he did. So he used to come watch our travel team play and support the kids he used to coach. And I was the coach at the time. So he used to watch me, and we kind of built a networking connection that way. And then when this opportunity came open, he said, I'm only doing this with, I'm only interviewing one person. If you're interested, I'm doing it. If you're not interested, I'm not, because I know you can do the job. So like you said, building your network and building relationships was huge.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like that's how we all pretty much move up in this, is because sure. We end up getting a job by someone that we know, or someone, you know, told us about an opening, something like that.
For sure.
So have you ever worked for a coach who was just a diehard, like system coach or dribble drive or pick and roll or something like that, and you weren't necessarily the biggest fan of it? And if you did, how did you adjust to that?
I had a coach who ran the Princeton offense, and then recruiting wanted, I call them non-pattern, called pattern players. So he wanted guys he knew could do X, Y, and Z, and didn't want them to do anything extra until he gained their trust. So we had pattern offense that we came down and ran every time. We probably in synergy were below average and anything in transition, and I love to run. So one thing I did is I hunkered down on skill development and I hunkered down on shooting, and kind of took away worrying about overall teaching the offense and making sure our players within the offense got better. So we worked on shots that you're just going to get in this offense and understand you may get 7 minutes a game, but if you go two for four, we might win by eight. But you're going to be wide open because the system is going to come down to us making shots in these certain spots. So I was not a fan of it when he first introduced it. He had just gotten hired. I was a returning person on staff, and I knew all the kids, and I was thinking this isn't going to work. So instead of kind of being the bad cop or trying to find a way to negotiate my opinion, I just kind of rolled with it and found my way to fit in with what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's great. And I came up with that question because I had a similar experience where, you know, I mean, I've worked for coaches that were diehard dribble drive fans, or mm-hmm. a coach who, you know, couldn't stand mid-range jumpers. And if you know me, like when I played, that was all I did was shoot mid-range. Yeah. So it was something that obviously your coaching staff has to buy into what you're doing, because the players won't. So I did exactly what you did. And, you know, my focus went elsewhere to like doing player development in the morning, individual sessions, things like that, focusing on defense instead of focusing so hard on maybe something that I didn't necessarily buy into, where I could kind of hide the fact that I didn't necessarily buy into the offense.
And the one thing I tried to do too, and this, you know, everybody, you know, listens to this, when you get in that situation, you're still going to have some half court sets you're going to have to run, or slobs or blobs. So like I said, when I was younger, I was really good with that pen and paper. So when we got in meetings, he's like, oh, we're getting stuck. You know, coming out of a timeout, I guess we just can't come down and run our stuff. So I would really dive into those conversations, like, hey, well, I got this play, or I got this set out of a slob, or I got this set. And he really started after a couple of years, was like, all right, Kevin, you've got all the south out of bounds and base out of bounds plays. So then I would really get a chance to continue to implement what I liked on and help him with what he wanted to run for us to get back, because he was a big fan of just throwing it in bounds on based on a bounce plays. And that just drives me crazy. Teams that just throw about the half court run, like just run a play. It's a free play. Just run it. So that was one way I could help implement my thought process and help sharpen myself as a coach, because he didn't really wasn't big on set plays or out of bounds plays, because he just wanted to come down and run the same. And when I mean the same, I mean the same inner at the elbow screen out of the corner and dribble handoff. It was the same every time. So it was hard at first, but we figured it out. Yeah.
I love that. So you are a big fan of quick hitters, it sounds like.
Oh yeah. I'm a big fan of, I was blessed to work for Jay Smith, and Jay Smith in Michigan is the all-time leading high school scorer. He's now the director of operations at the University of Michigan. He, and I stole this from him. I'm also a good thief, by the way. I want to teach you how to play. I don't want to run a bunch of plays. So we ran a bunch of motion when I worked for him. Two sides, you have screeners and cutters. There's no five man. Anybody can be a five man. And if we have to get a basket, we're going to have a gamut of plays. If I need to get you a mid-range jump shot, I'm going to run something set for you to get a shot where we know you're going to make it. Or you're comfortable. So like you're a mid-range shooter, it might be a down screen for you to curl going left instead of right or whatever. We're going to work on those things. Then when we do individual workouts with you, you're going to get 1,000 of those up on the gun. So when you start missing that shot in the game, I'm going to give you a funky look as an assistant. Like, man, we just shot 2,000 of those yesterday. Like, so he was big on repetition, motion offense with a mix of plays. And then of course, you know, just trying to make it the player as comfortable as possible. So if you're a mid-range shooter, why are we going to have you shooting a bunch of corner threes? You're not comfortable doing that. So that was huge for us.
Yeah, no, I love that. And that kind of leads into the next question. Throughout the course of your extensive career, what are some nuggets, and in addition to those, that you've taken away from other head coaches that you've worked for?
I mean, the big part of it is the defense. On the defensive side of the ball, if you're not rebounding, you're not winning. So if you're giving up offensive rebounds, you know, two big things I've learned from some coaches that I've worked for: if you're not rebounding, you're not winning. And if you're not taking charges as a team, you're not tough. If I'm charting charges and there's only two or three guys taking them, and those two or three guys aren't leading us in minutes, we got a problem. So I learned that at a couple stops and some coaches that I even talked to. Those are two big things. You go and look at a college game or a high school game, who's leading the rebounder and who's leading the team taking charges. If that person is leading you in minutes or up there in the top three or four, look at your record. So that's one of the big things. And then that last thing that people kind of forget about as the season goes on is in practice, every day we're going to shoot. Because at the end of the day, you got to put the ball in the basket. So every day we're in practice, we're going to shoot. We're going to get some shots up at some type of way. Even when the players love the light day, we're not going to go up and down as long. We're still going to, when we shoot, it's still going to be a game speed, a game tempo. So those are probably the big things I've picked up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm the same way. I probably do a shooting drill in between every 2 to 3 drills. And I'm not really that big on drills. I'll do a lot more playing because, you know, that's obvious with emphasizing things like rebounding and, you know, 2 points if this team gets an O board, things like that. But yeah, I'm a huge, huge proponent and believer in you need to be practicing your shot. I just don't trust my team to all be getting in extra shots. And, you know, I understand too, at the same time, they have all these things going on that not every single one of them is going to be putting in an extra hour or 45 minutes or 2 hours, maybe one or two will, but not everybody will. So it's not necessarily about trust. It's just about, they just won't do it, you know? And so that's my job. It's our job to make them work on it. I feel like a lot of coaches have bad shooting percentages from 3-point line or mid range and they're, and then it's like, they don't look at what they're practicing. You did 10 minutes of shooting in practice. What is that?
You know who really is not going to come in, coach, and shoot? The 14th player or 15th player, especially in college. Because the nice thing about coaching college is if you can work it out during their school day, that's the time for your individual session with that one player or two players, what they're breaking between class. So they get that 8 to 10:30, they don't have class till 1. Well, instead of letting them go back to them and play Fortnite twice a week, they got a shooting workout with me. And then we can have a conversation a little bit more laid back while you're not getting the minutes, quote unquote, you want. Like, well, I mean, besides these 2 days, when else you coming in shooting? Well, I'm not. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Coaches walk through the gym on the way out of the gym, not because they're cars parked inside the gym because they want to see who's in there. So if you're always in the gym, you get a better chance, especially if you're making shots. So, and I've been blessed to be with some head coaches who are big on charting things. At some levels, it's hard to because you don't have the manpower or you don't have enough people. But if you can chart and show the athlete where they're at as a competitor, I know right now if I'm at the bottom of the list shooting wise, I need to get to the top. I got to put more work in. So I've worked with some people too that charting was huge, like makes, misses, free throw make, misses. And then, you know, you want to play ran for your thing in the game, but you're shooting 20% in a drill that's timed. So things like that have been really good for me.
Oh yeah, totally. And if you're charting more, you know, obviously shooting, but if you're charting the other things too, like you were talking about charges, rebounding, things like that, usually what you'll find is your top five are usually your top five in those areas. So no one can really say, why is so-and-so playing over me? Well, here you go. Here's the chart right here. And now, you know,
So support your transparency, to support your theory of what you want to do. And the last little nugget that I picked up is the post-game talk, not in the locker room on away games, but on the bus ride home. Because what happens in the bus ride home? The players in the back of the bus complain about the coaches, and the coaches in the front of the bus complain about the players. Well, it's 2-hour ride. Let's flip the lights on. Let's all go back to the back of the bus. Let's have a conversation. And when we get off the bus, we're on to the next game or next practice or whatever. Luckily, I stole that from Jay Smith. And at first, it was one of those things that was like, really? We're going to sit back here for this 45 minutes of this ride and have a conversation. But really, all right, for the game, do you really want to have that conversation when everybody's trying to shower and get up and get out? No, because everyone's emotions are high from winning or losing. And we didn't just do it for losses. We did it for wins, too, which made it kind of nice. Yeah. So that's something else I learned, too. On the bus ride home, if you have that opportunity to be on the bus trip home after a win or a loss, have that team meeting on the bus because you can have everybody's attention because no one's got to can't go anywhere because you're on the same vehicle. So he learned that from his dad. They said they had many conversations in the car about things. And he just stood as a coach and just kept doing it.
Wow. I like that. We take vans, so there's not really, I mean, the back of the van isn't very far off, so there's not a lot of gossip. There might be like texting going on and things like that, but usually we're pretty quiet. I don't know if that's like a girl's thing or what, but when we lose, it's just a silent ride. No one's fighting for the aux cord or anything like that.
Right. And they kind of know if they're in your van, they should probably be really quiet.
Right, exactly. So who knows? Maybe the other van is, you know, lit. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. They're probably thinking, all right, who I didn't play well, I'm not riding coach's van. Like, can we switch? That's great.
Yay! All right, so tell me a little bit about the different cultures that you've been a part of.
Well, I've been a part of some really good ones, and I've been part of some ones that were player driven in a negative way, where we had the seniors who thought that freshmen should carry bags, freshmen sweep the floor for practice, freshmen should eat last. And I've been a part of some culture where it's been the assistant coaches sweep with everybody else, the head coach cleans the floor, everyone helps put away laundry. Both cultures, I've won in both cultures, but the one culture that was negative, in my opinion, I really see or get talk to those players or coaches, that staff anymore. The one that was super positive, I've been to 5 weddings, 4 or 5 baby shower gifts, and unfortunately we had to go to 1 funeral. So the positive culture, I've had a longer relationship with those people and more often communication. The culture that wasn't so good, I don't really speak to those guys that much anymore. They're kind of hard to get a hold of. And, you know, for everybody listening, if you're a player or a coach, that's why we get into this. You know, I want the call from, hey, coach, I'm having a baby, or hey, coach, I'm getting married, or hey, I got this job. Like, if they're calling you after they're done playing for you, that means that the 5 a.m. runs and the lifting and all that stuff paid off. So if your culture wasn't very good during those times, you're less likely to hear from those players that were in that situation.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about what made those cultures so good that you were a part of.
It was our leadership. It was transparent. Everyone had a say. We didn't have a dictatorship team meeting. It fluctuated, it flowed. The staff I'm on now, everybody has input on everything. He listened to everybody, then makes the final decision. I've been on staffs where that wasn't the case. I've been on staff when I'm the young assistant and I'm in a staff meeting and I go to talk and they'll look at me like I'm crazy. Like, hey, you're the young guy, why are you speaking? Type of thing. Which to me is automatically a negative because the players see that. They see they're looking crazy at you. So they're like, well, they're not even listening to you. You're the young guy. Why should I listen to you? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the thing that happened. I started coaching at 19, and I'm in my 40s now. So you can imagine being a young basketball coach on a staff that wasn't very connected mm-hmm. or made you feel like your job is to do the littlest jobs possible. And if you don't do them, we're going to make a really big deal. Like bringing the balls out to practice. Like that was one of my jobs. Well, we had a recruit on campus once. I can't be two places at once. The other's assistant didn't bring the balls out. So basically I could get chewed in front of the whole team if the balls run out. So that was the kind of culture I was dealing with as a young assistant for a little bit. And then of course I was blessed to leave that situation, but things I will learn, I've picked up negative and positive to never do. Like treat the young, new, up and coming coaches the right way so they can extend your coaching tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And that just goes kind of back to what we were talking about earlier. You don't know where those younger coaches end up going, you know. Yeah, they're young now, they're the new guy now, but you know what, in 5, 10, 15 years, they're not the new guy anymore. Right. So why burn that bridge? You know, I just think that just across the board, I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's like, it's also too, at the same time, like, well, why'd you hire me then? Why'd you hire me if you're going to look at me like I'm crazy for, you know, speaking my mind, especially when I think across the board, there are head coaches who say that they want to be challenged, that they don't want a yes man. And then sometimes and there's those few head coaches where they are challenged and they don't have a yes man. They all of a sudden they're like, whoa, 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 what are you doing challenging me?
Correct.
So it's just, it goes back to, and I was just talking about this the other day, just, you know, walk the walk and talk the talk. Don't just talk the talk. Don't be the type of person who says, oh yeah, no, I'm transparent and I want someone to challenge me, but then you aren't transparent and you don't really want to be challenged. It's just...
And I was blessed to be in those situations, because now I am where I am because I was there. But it's also like, remember that when you're six inches over, you know, I'm really close. I think you interviewed him before with Charles Belt, who's at William Woods. We had a conversation. He goes, now that I moved over 6 inches, I understand some of the things my head coach was doing at the time when I worked for, but I still don't want to do those things. So you have to understand that, yeah, you're the assistant, but you're working to be a head coach. So to be a head coach, you've got to understand what your head coach is doing. If you agree or disagree, don't change who you are to fit to be somebody else. Still be who you are. So you're out. If you want your assistants to do more and dive in and have a bigger role, cool. If you don't, you have to be able to explain to them why they don't have such a big role. Or especially young assistants, because we're trying to learn every day and be a sponge. The good assistants I have that have been younger than me now, it's constant communication. It's every day. It's questions. It's this and that. Just all types of things in basketball. And at the college level, some people may or may not know, you have to make sure when you're coaching in college that you're representing the program 24/7. Grocery store, barbershop, recruiting trip, the Final Four. Like, and every time you walk around, if you're a coach, you know the first thing people do is look for your logo. So you have to be making sure you're doing the right things all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then as far as responsibility goes for assistant coaches, just like you were touching on, and even with bringing up Charles Belt's interview, at the same time, you know, if you're an assistant coach who doesn't just want to be in charge of putting tabs on your head coach's folder or getting the balls together for practice, well, then you need to prove that you are the most amazing ball boy, ball girl, cone getter, tab. And then all of a sudden, you know, it turns into, hey, can you also do this? Hey, can you also do this? And then at halftime, hey, how should we guard this player? What? Like what?
And then have an answer, coach. But then have an answer. Yep. Be so engaged with what's going on. I think that's why I've had some success, is when the conversation started to come, then the light bulb would really go off. Like, wait a minute. Like he did all, like I was in charge of travel 1 year for all of our trips. And it was like, make sure I did it right. And I spend all this time on travel, but then my high school coach, my mentor, said, hey, I get you doing travel, it's a part of your daily duties, but your nose better be in that playbook and on that film, because at some point he's going to ask you about how to guard so and so for their team, and if you don't know, you're just going to be doing travel the rest of your coaching career. So I understand the travel piece is important, but make sure you're still doing the X's and O's piece and player development piece. And I think that's, you know, how many hats can you wear? And if you coach at a smaller level, you have more opportunity to do more things. And I think that's huge too. You know, for somebody who's been in small college a long time, I know I can be able to do something at a higher level because I've had to wear so many hats in small college, because you have so many few people. Like a Division III staff or a junior college staff, you got two people maybe, or one person and a student assistant, you know, and like someone's got to run the subway and get the order and bring it back. You don't have like 12 managers like some of these other big time schools have. So you have to be more flexible to be able to handle more tasks at once and still do the basketball part.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we're talking about being flexible and also balancing multiple tasks, multiple hats, and also life. So tell me, how have you managed balancing coaching with your outside life? Because I know that at times that can just be damn near impossible.
Well, the first thing I did was fall in love with an athletic trainer as a wife. So I married somebody who's in the same field as me. And there's times where I'm her assistant coach or I'm helping her fold towels on her job. So she's a head athletic trainer. So that was the first thing I did. And the second thing I did is I make sure I make downtime for myself. The older I get, the more I realize it can't be 24/7 anymore, because you can burn yourself out. And then you're not working to learn, you're just working. Now, it sounds kind of corny to say that, but a lot of coaches do that. You're just watching Synergy all night and watching video because you don't want to spend any time with your loved ones. You don't want to spend any time doing anything else. Having a child helped, of course, change that as well. But now you have to be able to balance your time and understand that when you're in the mode of coaching mode and you're grinding and you're working, you got to be able to put it down or leave it at the office and go home and do something else. So on the recruiting side, which I'm doing basically all the time now, I still plan out my day to where it's not texting and calling kids 24/7. I have time to, you know, there's no phones at the dinner table at our house. So that's one of the things to balance out what I try to do daily.
Yeah, that's great. And I hear you, especially with the recruiting side of things. I like to plan out, you know, on this day, I'm going to text all of my recruits. And that way I know pretty much every day of the week that I plan out, okay, this is the day that I'm in my recruiting zone. I know that I'm going to have a million text messages from all the responses that I'm going to get, hopefully. That way I don't just have every day of the week all these recruits texting me back and things like that. So I definitely hear you, and I'm still working on the no phone at the dinner table. That one's a hard one for me, but we'll see. Baby steps.
Yeah, I just think it was something that I had to do, because you can be in the room but you can't be present. I don't know. Mm-hmm. My mom was a cop. I don't know if I mentioned that. My mom was also a police officer. So she worked a 13-hour shift and then sit down at dinner and be still thinking about her calls. And so like it's like talking to somebody, they're not really listening. So yeah. I had people in my life who kind of, it was tough love at first with the no phone, no cell phone. And then growing up, it was the same way, some discipline. But now I understand why, because you want to hear about that. Like I want to hear about my wife's day. You know, so many meals I had by myself as a young coach in the office, sleeping on the futon because I wanted to get to this point and have a family and those kind of things. So it kind of puts things in perspective.
Yeah. All right. So we touched on recruiting, and that's going to lead into this next question. Tell me, as a recruiting coordinator now, how has that process, the process of recruiting, changed over time from your first year as a college coach being introduced to having to recruit athletes to now? How has it changed?
My first year as a college coach, my job was to go get a Diet Coke, a box of Grenadier cigars, print off the MapQuest directions, and sit in the car for my head coach to shower after practice. I would drive my head coach to games, sit next to him at games, watch the game. When the game is over, go back out to the car, scrape the car off because I live in Michigan, wait for him to run back out to the car, and drive him home. That was my first year recruiting. I never went on a trip by myself. I didn't speak to a recruit working for him till they came on campus. So it's completely changed now. Now I'm on the phone all the time. I've got, you know, field level, NCSA, scouting services. I'm in charge of our whole database for at Stout for everything we do recruiting-wise, who's calling who's calling when, talking to high school coaches. I recruit multiple states because of a league like the WIAC, you have to get players from all over to be really good. So it's completely changed from being a driver, literally a driver. But in those drives, let me make this very clear, I learned a lot about recruiting in the car rides with a guy with 45 years of coaching experience.
Okay,
thank
God.
He was going to do it his way. And I printed off the MapQuest directions for no reason, because he knew every shortcut to every school in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois. But he would tell me stories, and I still talk to him to this day. His name is Joe Hacklin. He was my first boss, but he wanted to make sure I was doing it exactly how he wanted it. And that's how he taught me. Instead of sitting me on my own and letting me fall flat on my face, he showed me how he wanted it done. So, for example, we don't sit by the parents during the game. We want to go sell out during halftime. And after the game, we speak to the player and we leave. If you are, we're at rival schools and we're at a high school game and you drove further than we did, you're going to get to go first and talk to the kid because you have a further drive home. Things like that I've never forgotten. Kind of unwritten rules in recruiting that when you're 19, 20, all right, I'm going to go recruit. I'm going to get all these players. And he also said, we need players that are going to fit what we do. I don't need a list of 75 kids that you think are really good. The kid that might fit us may not fit somebody else. So because they're recruiting them, doesn't mean we have to. Mm-hmm. So that was something that stuck with me for a long time. And recruiting has really changed. I mean, even with or without COVID, with travel basketball, and, you know, we have some kids in some states. I use Colorado, for example. There's not too many Division III schools in Colorado or any other, there's any in Utah. So you'd be amazed how many emails I get from those areas because those kids want to play small college basketball. And they've had teammates or friends go to schools in the Midwest like ours. So they know to continue their playing career, they all can't go to Colorado College or school of mines. They've got to go to a school like ours. So the out-of-state recruiting, the regional out-of-state recruiting has really changed in the last 15, 16 years.
Wow. All right, Coach, my last question for you is, do you have any advice for aspiring coaches?
Yes. Don't put the level you want to on a dartboard at the bullseye. It's going to be about fit. You want to be John Calipari. Well, there are some things that you're going to have to do to get to that level, and there might be some bumps in the road. Your fit doesn't make you a good coach. What level you are, or I have to be Division I, that solidifies me as a good coach. Does that make sense? Or I'm Division II. If you are a Division III coach in Wisconsin and you are happy and you're developing relations with young people and you're impacting people's lives in your community, then you're the best coach for that situation. Coach for the job you have, be positive, work hard, network in the right way. And then the last and most important thing, if you're in this athletic business, understand that one mistake can lead to three or four. So if you make a mistake as a young coach, own up to it. Own up to your boss or whoever you work for, your AD, and then learn from that. Don't think you're above the rules and those kind of things. But don't make an aspirations and goals that you have to do this and have to do that, because you may turn down a great opportunity because it's not Division I, or you want to coach on the men's side only and it's a great job on the women's side and you turn it down because you don't want to coach women. And then all of a sudden, you're with no options. So keep all your options open. I tell guys that in recruiting as well. Like, don't just look down on this type of level because you think you have to go this way to be solidified in your situation in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I've talked to so many coaches, even on this podcast, that they have, you know, a big mind and big eyes for Division One, and they are at where they are at. They have been for the past, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And they learn real quickly that it's not about going Division One. It's about, just like you said, a great fit, you know. So a great fit for you might be D3, a great fit for me might be junior college. I don't know, but right. I know for me it is.
Right. And the turtle on the men's side, if you think about it, you don't have to be a mathematician to realize what is the highest turnover rate for men's basketball coaches. What level is it? It's Division One. So you get there, you're there for 3 or 4 years, and you leave because you get fired, or you're on a staff and the whole staff just let go. There's very few coaches. I mean, hoop dirt is the greatest thing ever, both sides, men and women's. But you look at that thing in the springtime, oh my goodness, don't make that a notification on your Twitter, because it's going to go off every 5 seconds. This job's open, this job's open, this job's open. So, like, be mindful of that, because you want to have what I have, which is an amazing wife and son. Moving them every 4 years probably isn't going to be a very good, I'm not going to have a happy camper, I know that. To be at certain levels, you got to understand you're going to take some, that person has to be committed to you doing that. And if they are, that's great. But on the men's side, there's so much turnover and there's so many great young coaches coming. It's going to be hard to solidify your spot. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think too, just like you said, I mean, if you're a coach who goes after a lot of jobs and you don't get anything, or you turn a few down, it's okay, because just like you said, in the springtime, there's a lot of movement. So if you don't get the job you want this year, if you don't get any job, you might get that job next year.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll say on that is, like, I'm not in a position. I love the position I was at and I was looking, but I was pick, I wanted to be with somewhere where someone was loyal, that understood my skill set, and understood that I was assistant coach with 16 years experience, not six or not three. So I didn't want to get babysat. I didn't want to have to, you know, do certain things that some assistants on some staffs will do. And I found that. But willing to sit out for a year because I didn't find that, I was ready to handle that as it came. I think young coaches need to understand you may not, that job may not be the best fit for you right now where you are in your life. Mm-hmm. You know, right now where I am in my life, I can have this position that I'm at. I don't know if I would have taken this at 21, 22. And then, you know, look at doing as many camps and clinics as possible. I know it sounds cliche. I know it sounds old, but there's things all over the country that still go on, still camps and clinics. Hoop group has always been a big one for me. I love the hoop group people. I would die, if I'm a young coach, I'd try to find a way to work their camps because they're really networking and they help coaches get jobs. So that would be something I'd definitely look into if I was a young aspiring coach.
Yeah, no, definitely. I hear you on the clinics and things like that, because not only can you learn, but just like we've been talking about really this whole episode, networking, it's huge at those platforms.
Yeah, and you got to be kind of, and you got to have a little, you know, it's like I mentioned before, Charles and I are really, really good friends, Charles Bell. If you could, you know, if you had a conversation with me and Charles, you'd never get a word in because we were very similar personalities. But
no.
that's how we met. I mean, we met sitting next to each other at an AAU tournament, and I'm watching a kid, and he's at the Division II school, and I'm at Division III school, and he literally told me that eight kids actually in the gym watching, four of them ended up coming to play for me. So here's the eight kids in this gym right now. You should be recruiting. I'm like, first of all, who are you? He goes, I'm just letting you know. I know who you are. I know your school. Let's sit down and have a chat. Let's go to lunch. And you know, Charles, I was like, okay. And literally, four of the eight, they weren't the top four, by the way, but four of the eight, I actually ended up recruiting and coming to play for me. But it's all about relationships. It's 100% about that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Coach, thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it. I appreciate you working with my schedule today and yesterday. I really enjoyed this conversation. And now that I know that you're really close with Charles Belt, we need to get on in on a group chat or something. Because
sounds like a great plan, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Well, I hope. Are you guys having a season this year?
Yeah, so we're going to start in January. Okay. And, of course, if people that don't know about the WIAC, we're all the state schools of Wisconsin. There's only one Division II school in our state. But at little pitch for Stout, we do have 10,000 students. We have 50 majors and 22 master's programs. So it's a little bit different field than most Division III institutions because we're so much bigger. But the last three or four, we usually get two or three teams in the NCAA tournament. Wisconsin Oshkosh just won the NCAA tournament Division III a couple years ago. So our league is really good. We're really excited. Our kids are excited. And I'm excited as recruiting coordinator to help fill that roster each year with more and more talent.
That's awesome. Well, I wish you all the best, and I hope you guys have a successful season.
Thank you very much.